My heart, my blood, my body, I give to you, Satan.
Now, the shocking truth about witchcraft, as it exists in our cities and suburbs, is exposed in Witchcraft 70. Hidden cameras probe today's unspeakable cults to document the rites and the rituals when and where they happened. Witchcraft 70. Now see actual human sacrifice on the altar of Baal. Witness the weird rites of the cult of Kali. See the sensual ecstasies of the hippie families. Watch as the Church of Satan celebrates its infamous Black Mass. Witchcraft 70. You will see macabre orgies of a secret sect of evil and hear the erotic prayers of our so-called civilized world and much, much more in explicit color and detail. See Witchcraft 70. It is rated X.
Welcome to the Sleazecast.
Satan's there. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come to the
Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath. Come to the Sabbath. Satan's there. Secret art, who dares to help me raise the one whose spirit name fills my heart? After all!
Thank you, Black Widow, there, who are inviting us to, rather appropriately, inviting us to come to the Sabbath. And I say appropriately because this is the edition of the Sleazecast where we look at what's termed high strangeness. That's right, all things paranormal, be it cryptozoology, psychics, spiritualism, UFOs, alien abductions. Yep, we're going to cover it all here in this edition. But as we've been invited to a Sabbath by Black Widow, it'd be rather remiss of us if we didn't start with the subject of witchcraft. I'm sure we all have our own ideas of what witchcraft is, and indeed what witches are like. I mean, for many it's the traditional medieval image of some old hag with a pointed hat flying around on a broomstick with a black cat as a familiar, placing hexes on people. Whereas for others, we have the more modern idea of witches as being those slightly sad and strange people who go to those sabbats that Black Widow was inviting us to, which these days we have envisaged as being held in ordinary suburban houses and basically used by people as an excuse to get naked, dance round, drink some wine and chant a bit. However, who better to tell us about modern witchcraft and its practice than an actual practicing witch?
Okay, I think a witch has got to be female. I don't believe it's possible for a male personality to occupy himself with this type of activity. And besides being female, a witch has to be psychic. And I think that anyone who says they practice witchcraft and is not highly intuitive and doesn't have extrasensory perception is lying to themselves, because you have to be able to project your emotions and influence your environment along the same bridge that you would ordinarily be receiving impressions from.
What was the history of witchcraft? Where did it come from?
Well, I think witchcraft has existed ever since the beginning of man. Anytime a man, mankind, attempts to alter his destiny in some way with various methods that may have nothing at all to do with anything obvious. Whenever you take an inanimate object and you say, this is going to bring me love, or this is going to bring me courage or happiness or wealth, that's witchcraft. And I think man has always needed to do this, and witchcraft has always existed.
What about the religious aspects of witchcraft, or organized covens?
Well, there are organized covens today that I don't really value too much. I think a lot of them are people looking for some kick, wanting to find another way of existing. They may be sincere, but I don't think they have anything to do with religion. Most of them that I've had contact with are not terribly informed about the religious origin of the witchcraft they say they're practicing. And the Druid religion, you know, has gone out of existence quite some time ago.
Where did you get, you know, your knowledge of witchcraft?
Well, I come from a group of witches who believe that it's a very personalized action. My grandmother's a witch, and my grandmother's great-grandmother was a witch. I'm six generations of witches. And I learned from my grandmother when I was a very young child. how to do all sorts of little things that she thought were very potent and important, how to make packets and amulets and cast spells and, you know, perform rituals, and use all sorts of methods to read into the future. And she was convinced that the objects were the things that had the magic in them, and I'm convinced that she had the magic in her energy and her emotion and her subconscious, and that's where the thing took place.
Give us sort of an example of a ritual or spell that, you know, would be used for a specific end, and, you know, how would this work?
Well, there are all sorts of things that you can do. I'm convinced that if you create your own spell, it has a greater effect on your life. But very many people don't have the confidence to do this as beginners. So I think a simple spell is to light the flame of a candle and to sprinkle a circle of salt around the area that holds the candle and you, and then write down on a piece of paper what it is you want to accomplish in very simple statement, maybe a sentence or two, and then burn this in the flame of the candle, all the while concentrating very dynamically upon the effect of the flame. And when you have burned this to an ash, then you know that what you want is about to come your way. The main purpose in the practice of witchcraft is to generate within yourself a very high level of energy that will then carry you successfully through all situations. So the main point is to psych yourself up and reach some kind of an emotional, physical, intellectual high. And this is done through a very rigid, disciplined method of performing a ritual. The people who say they are witches, and there are very many thousands of them in the United States, may or may not be witches. That I don't know. I haven't gone through any special sort of a research or a survey on this. But there are very many thousands more who don't say they're witches, who do practice. There are men who are in very high office who utilize the abilities of witches and who are convinced that these things work. And scattered throughout the world, I couldn't say them, probably are millions. Witchcraft only works so long as the witch is capable of sustaining the energy needed, and I think the witch is at times able to falter. So long, you have to be obsessed with what you're doing. You have to become completely involved in it and almost psychopathic about getting the thing you want. And if you're not able to sustain that high pitch of psychosis and obsession, you don't do it. You can't cast the spell. So it works so long as you work at it. And it doesn't work when you become a little bit normal.
Well, you know, what do you feel, you know, then is the value of witchcraft as opposed to just, you know, being a psychic?
I think psychics are a very passive lot. And a witch utilizes that same ability to sense and know and feel. But she sends out information rather than merely receives it. And she's able to activate conditions and stimulate the environment into certain directions. I am psychic, but I use it in another way. I don't just receive thoughts. It's too passive a role for me.
Do you think that most people have the ability to become a witch?
Or? No, I don't. I don't think most people can become witches any more than most people can write or dance or sing or paint. I think you're born with the ability. You don't have to be born into a family of witches, but you definitely have to be born with the emotional capacity. And in the same way that everyone can't possibly project the emotion of love on a movie screen, everyone can't perform witchcraft either.
Louise Hubner there, speaking on the 1974 LP, Occult Explosion.
Traditionally, of course, witches and witchcraft have been portrayed by the authorities as being totally evil. The practitioners of witchcraft being painted as being in league with Satan himself. Indeed, many confessions extracted from supposed witches, particularly at the time of the English Civil War, when the likes of Matthew Hopkins were running around East Anglia torturing confessions out of people. Many of these confessions focused on them actually having sex with the devil in order to gain their evil powers. However, the witchcraft tradition itself, modern practitioners, some of whom call themselves Wiccans, claim they are, of course, simply a survival of a more ancient religion. Certainly here in these shores in the UK, that's the view they take. Something that predates Christianity, and that obviously they say is in Christianity's interest to recast them, the Wiccans, as being evil and in league with the devil. Well, what is the truth? I don't know, but certainly the authorities in this country, even as recently as 1944, were still prosecuting people for witchcraft. Now, these prosecutions in the mid-1940s were quite interesting and resurfaced again, the story of at least one of them, on television recently because of the publication of a recent book on the subject. But unfortunately, the facts are often lost in the sensationalisation. According to this recent book, for instance, this particular unfortunate woman from the Isle of Wight was prosecuted because it was feared because that she would reveal the secrets of D-Day because it was claimed her amazing powers of witchcraft enabled her to raise spirits of dead sailors and reveal a sinking of a ship that hadn't been made public, and this could be a threat to the war effort. The reality of the situation was rather different. The ship in question was HMS Barham, a British battleship, that was indeed sunk in the Mediterranean. She was torpedoed by a U-boat, and unfortunately, although the damage from the torpedoes wouldn't normally have sunk her, her magazines in the ensuing firing, her magazines exploded, causing the ship basically to blow up and sink with a massive loss of life. Hundreds of sailors died. This particular medium, it is said, was able to contact some of the dead spirits of the dead sailors from this wreck, and were able to tell relatives that they were dead, which the relatives didn't know because the sinking of the Barham had been kept secret. Now, whilst it's true that the British government had suppressed information about the sinking of the Barham for several weeks, this was due to the fact that the U-boat which sank her had to crash dive machine, and so the captain didn't know whether he actually sunk the Barham or not. And obviously the Royal Navy didn't want the Germans to know they'd sunk a battleship in the Mediterranean, because they thought the fleet was under strength there. It might affect their plans. They might be emboldened to attack more convoys or whatever. Also, there's the knowledge that it could be a propaganda victory for the Germans. So they suppressed information about it. There's no public announcement for several months, in fact. The ship had been sunk. However, the fact is that relatives of dead crew members were informed what had happened, but sworn to secrecy. So all of a sudden it becomes less mysterious, this woman being able to allegedly have knowledge of something that was being kept secret, because the odds are that somebody told her, one of the relatives told someone who told her, and she therefore had the came into this information and was able to exploit it. And the reason, of course, that she was prosecuted, she and another woman, also in 1944, were prosecuted because they'd set themselves up as mediums and were allegedly contacting the spirits of dead soldiers and sailors and airmen, and the government at the time felt that this was an exploitation of the bereaved, and it just seemed at the time they found the Witchcraft Acts were still on the was still on the statute book, as yet seemed the quickest and easiest way, was to prosecute these women under the Witchcraft Acts. In actual fact, I believe both of them were eventually convicted of fraud rather than witchcraft. But that's not such a good story. And there's all sorts of embellishments, like the woman involved with the Barham case was visited in her cell by none other than Winston Churchill. There's absolutely no evidence of this whatsoever. Or is there, though it is notable, of course, that Churchill himself was the man who later in the 1950s repealed the Witchcraft Acts. So who knows, perhaps he was secretly a witch. But there you have it. As with many of these things, it turns out to be fraudulent. As a witchcraft, in this case, sort of spiritualism, the two become very interlinked, especially in this modern age. In fact, one of the main manifestations of witchcraft in our modern age is still the world of spiritualism. And spiritualism, as we will see, has a long, long history of fraudulent practices.
Section 40 of Library of the World's Best Mystery and Detective Stories, Volume 6. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Phil Chenevert. Library of the World's Best Mystery and Detective Stories, Volume 6, by Julian Hawthorne, Editor. Section 40. Some Famous Exposures. Probably the greatest swindle ever perpetrated in the name of spiritualism was recently brought to light in Stockton, California. The medium and his confederates materialized everything from frogs and small fish to a huge boulder of gold quartz weighing several hundred pounds. This latter had to be brought from the mountains with a mule team. The materializing was done through sliding panels in the walls, while the believer sat holding hands about the opposite side of a table and loudly singing sacred hymns. They had the only door to the room locked and sealed, and never dreamed that the spirits who brought the quartz from the mines were mules. Thousands of dollars were invested in this spirit mine, the believers stacking their money on the quartz as it lay on the table at a dark seance, and receiving deeds in return for their money, which the spirits dematerialized. The medium established, or had his spirits establish, a treasury of heaven for the faithful to deposit their money in, and on which they were to receive 50% interest. This interest the believers continued to receive at dark seances from the spirits for a time. Each sitter's interest was found on the table, stacked in front of him when the lights were lighted. When the spirit bank became insolvent and the chief medium disappeared, the believers were out about $35,000. No less personage than a millionaire of Tacoma, Washington, is said to have contributed largely to this spirit fund. I had known of this case for some time before the exposure, conducted by a performer engaged for the purpose, and who knew that certain interested persons were contemplating bringing it about, in order to rescue certain estimable persons from the clutches of these mediums. This was successful, and the confederates of the mediums signed written confessions in the presence of one of the most devout of the believers, and a gentleman who is otherwise very intelligent. Upon this the gentleman was greatly crestfallen, but he still insists that there are certain mediums who are not impostors, and that certain mediums in Chicago who produce spirit portraits are genuine. A full and very interesting account of this exposure is given in the San Francisco Examiner of March 3rd and 4th, 1907. I could report enough cases of materialization to fill a volume. These I know of from various sources, and in every case they were invariably fraudulent. I will give a short account of a materialization which a very expert medium, who is on friendly terms with me, witnessed. The gentleman was originally a minister, and afterwards began investigating spiritualism, as he was a believer in it. He hoped to become a medium, and at one time paid two lady mediums of some renown, who reside in Chicago, $3 a sitting for three sittings a week. These sittings were conducted for the purpose of developing this gentleman in mediumship. He continued these for a long time, but he was no nearer to being a medium than he was in the beginning. At one time he detected one of the sisters passing a slate to the other and substituting another in its place. He saw the edge of one of the slates protruding from behind the dress of one of the sisters. They never knew they were discovered, as he said nothing, but this opened his eyes. After this he investigated everywhere and at every opportunity, and grew to be a very expert medium himself. Recently, when in Los Angeles, he visited a séance conducted by a medium who claimed to be a Buddhist priest. This medium was known under the name of the Reverend Swami Mazininanda. He had an altar in his home, constructed something like those in Roman Catholic churches. He had various candles and images on this altar, including an image of Buddha and also a number of mystical figures. It was a great mixture of fake Buddhism, Roman Catholicism, and modern spiritualism. The medium also wore the costume of a Buddhist priest at his seances. This priest held services here for the faithful. He conducted all in Hindustani, his native tongue. He chanted, prayed to Buddha, etc., all in a queer-sounding gibberish. Certain evenings of the week were devoted to soul travel, and certain evenings after the religious services a black chapter was held. The gentleman whom I have mentioned attended one of these dark seances. He sat with other spectators around the room in perfect darkness. The spectators were not required to hold hands, so great was their faith. Finally, in the darkness, a queer-looking, vapory, luminous form floated around in the air and paused in front of the spectators. My friend slipped down quietly on his knees and gradually worked closer and closer to the luminous form until he could detect that the vapor was a kind of luminous cheesecloth. He did not desire to expose this priest, but he desired to have the priest know that someone had discovered him. My friend accordingly took hold of the gauze and gave it a very slight downward jerk. He then immediately returned quietly to his seat. There was an immediate pause in the discourse of the priest, who had really been floating this form on the end of a stick. Everyone knew that something had happened, but no one but my friend knew what it was. The priest then said, in his slow, peculiar, eccentric, and measured tones, "I have received a very great shock, and I will be unable to continue further this evening." The next day, when in conversation with some of the faithful, this priest stated in his peculiar manner of speaking, and with intense earnestness, that which follows. "Last night I received a very great shock. I was just in the middle of the dark chapter, and the spirit of the Master Krishna was out. Having spent the greater portion of my life on the Himalayas, my right eye has become injured by the snows." Then, pointing to his right eye, he added, "My right eye has a defect in it which you cannot see, but on account of that I can only see in the dark with it. I immediately turned my right eye downward, and I looked. I distinctly saw a lady's hand reach out toward my robe in the darkness, and this hand took hold of it and jerked it lightly, just like this." The Reverend Swami here illustrated by slightly jerking his coat downward. It was very amusing to hear him, in great seriousness, relate this in his low and measured accents to his faithful followers. Shortly after this, when the Los Angeles Herald was conducting a crusade against the numerous mediums of that city, and when it had an exhibit in its windows of the confiscated material of some of them, this Buddha priest was arrested and imprisoned for some of his practices. End of chapter 40.
Hi, I'm Susie Sleaze with the latest paranormal news. Cryptozoologists have descended on Brumley after a local woman claimed to have had a close encounter with an elephant. The first I knew of it was when there was this huge jolt as I was reversing off of the driveway. I thought I'd hit something in the road. Imagine my surprise when I looked in the rear view mirror to discover that an adult African bull elephant had mounted the back of the car and was proceeding to bounce up and down on it. His thrusting was so vigorous that both rear tires burst and the suspension collapsed. The 46-year-old housewife told her local newspaper, "I can only imagine that he mistook my car for a female elephant. It is great, and in the certain light a Fiat Bravitish bear passing resemblance to an elephant." However, she was not entirely surprised to see an elephant on a suburban street. There have been reports of strange trumpeting sounds coming from the local park after dark, she says. "And only the other night I thought I saw something big and grayish in my headlights as it ran across the road and vanished into a hedgerow. At first I thought it was just a stray dog, but now I'm sure it was an elephant. It definitely had a trunk." Unfortunately, she was unable to get a photo of the beast, which vanished as suddenly as it had appeared, nor was the incident witnessed by any of her neighbors. Consequently, her insurance company has cast doubt on her version of events. "They're refusing to pay out, saying that I reversed the car into my garage wall. It's not true. The wall has been like that for months, ever since it was damaged by a rampaging hippo," she says. Meanwhile, residents of a quiet called DSAC in Reading are claiming that they have been subjected to a reign of psychic terror by their neighbor, famed Israeli psychic Uri Gellert. They believe that Gellert's sex life, amplified by his strange powers, is causing massive disruption to their electrical appliances and other household implements. "My entire drawer of cutlery bent out of shape when he masturbated," complained one elderly female neighbor. "As if it wasn't bad enough, my bone-handled knives and forks curling up like that. When he reached what I believe is referred to as the vinegar stroke, the drawer burst open and all the cutlery flew out and embedded itself in the kitchen wall. I was lucky not to be impaled." The residents claimed that far worse than spoon bending occurs when the famed mentalist has sexual intercourse. "I've had 3 television sets explode this year already," claimed a male occupant of the street. "Last time it happened while I was watching Top Gear. The picture began to go all strange and fuzzy, then there was a huge flash and the whole set blew up. It obviously coincided with him climaxing. I could hear his groan as he came from across the street." Finally, a man in Bath has told of how shower sex toys rained down on his house. "It was incredible. Dildos and vibrators just started falling out of a blue sky. The first thing I knew about it was when I heard something clattering on the roof. Of course, I just assumed it was hailstones. But when I looked out of the window, I saw this shower of sex aids landing in my garden," says Danny Levy. "It must have lasted for about 2 minutes, leaving the entire garden covered with the things. Bizarrely, it seemed that only our house was affected. I know it seems amusing now, but it was bloody frightening at the time. My wife was hanging out the washing at the time and was struck and seriously injured by a king-sized dildo. Not only that, but several of our roof tiles were cracked." However, following the deluge of dildos, insurance investigators refused to believe the Levy's story and refused to pay out for either Mrs. Levy's injuries or repairs to the roof, telling the Bath couple that even if the damage had been caused by flying sex aids, it would have been classified as an act of God. "Why the hell would God be throwing huge rubber penises at my house?" asks the bemused Levy. The source of the sex aids remains a mystery. That's all for now. More paranormal news soon.
In the annals of cryptozoology, perhaps the most famous cryptozoid of them all is the Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, Yeti, or whatever name. In many remote parts of the world, many cultures have their own versions of this strange half-man, half-ape creature. It seems to live in remote mountain areas or forest areas. There must have been many tantalizing photographs which seemed to show something. None have ever been conclusive. Is this creature some kind of prehistoric survival? Is it the missing link between man and ape? Well, so far this question has been unanswered. But one of the most perplexing of all Bigfoot sightings was that from 2 years ago in the sleepy Hampshire town of Stockbridge. Nestling in the English countryside, this seems an unlikely venue for a strange beast like this to put an appearance. Yet incredibly, one February night, a local woman, a Miss Barbara Staines, claimed to have encountered this creature in the ladies' toilets of a local pub, the Three Greyhounds.
I just flushed the toilet and stepped down to the cubicle, and there he was, urinating into the sink. And as he peed into the sink, there was this loud rasping noise, and this horrible odour hit me. Just indescribably evil. Like something long dead. I'm afraid, you know, it's just so disgusting. I lost consciousness. And when I recovered, he'd vanished.
But this wasn't to be the last that Miss Staines was to see of the creature that night. Because later on the evening, whilst driving home, she had another terrifying encounter.
I could see him quite clearly in my headlamps. He seemed to be squatting in the middle of the road. I mean, like he was taking a dump or something. I mean, it really did look like he had his trousers round his ankles. I mean, but that's ridiculous, because obviously, you know, he's an ape man, he didn't wear trousers. Anyway, I swerved to avoid him, but still caught him a glancing blow and knocking him off balance. As I looked in my rearview mirror, I could see this beast picking itself up, its own excrement apparently smeared all down one side. But before it limped off into the trees, it shook its fist at me and hurled what appeared to be a beer can at the car. I just drove on and didn't look back after being down that road since.
In the second sighting that night, the assistant manager of a local off-license claimed to also have encountered the beast, later telling the press that it was just after 11 when the creature walked in, bold as brass. He described him as being over 6 feet tall, covered in thick black fur, and had huge feet and piercing red eyes. According to the assistant manager, the creature didn't say a word, just picked up a case of lager, brought up the till and slapped down a £20 note before walking out. He noted that the strangest thing about the whole incident was the creature didn't even wait for his change. Naturally, in the wake of this well-publicised sighting, cryptozoologists and monster hunters descended upon the town of Stockbridge, determined to get to the bottom of this most bizarre of sightings of the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or whatever we wish to call this creature. Dick Downshire from the Centre for Unusual Things, an organisation dedicated to investigating Fortean phenomena, takes up the story.
Oh, see, the witness descriptions and physical evidence all pointed to a classic Bigfoot-type hominid. Whilst obviously skeptics might try and dismiss this, of course, claiming it is highly unlikely that such a prehistoric survival could be found wandering around a small Hampshire town like this, completely unknown for many years. There are precedents, of course. I mean, the business of the Regent's Park gorilla, which frightened that woman a couple of years ago, or of course the very well documented case of the Yeti that allegedly drove a taxi in Kathmandu for several years. So there is precedent for this sort of thing.
However, rival monster hunter Arthur Doc Swack, a practicing white witch, believed that Downshire and his scientific methods wouldn't find the creature. Indeed, he believed that Downshire and his colleagues were barking up the wrong tree entirely by trying to find a flesh-and-blood ape-man in the Hampshire countryside.
Cryptozoologist? Craptozoologist, more like. Him and his type 2 blinkered by conventional science. See the truth, These creatures are elementals who simply tap into our subconscious fears and desires in order to find a physical form. All the technology in the world wasn't going to capture this beast. The only way to summon him is by invoking ancient powers through the enactment of arcane magical rituals.
The plans of both monster hunters were quickly thrown into confusion. Once the police announced that not only had they shot dead an ape man in woods outside Stockbridge, but the creature had turned out to be a man in a gorilla suit. Indeed, Inspector Tom Cush of Hampshire Constabulary told a packed press conference that the so-called ape man had been shot after an unsavoury incident at a nearby children's playground. Apparently a group of 10-year-olds had found the creature lying prone under the swings, its inert form strewn with simian-related pornography. Sadly, the children had made the mistake of poking him with sticks to see if he was still alive, at which point he sat up and hurled an empty vodka bottle at them before collapsing again. Alerted the presence of the ape man by the terrified children, who obviously had fled the scene, armed police officers rushed to the playground. By the time they arrived, the only trace they could find of him, the patch of foul-smelling urine beneath the swings. However, as Inspector Cush related, by following a trail of discarded porn, mainly pages torn from King Dong's Big Banana Capers, they were able to track him through the woods to his lair. Unfortunately, they were forced to shoot the beast when it became enraged and attacked them, hurling empty beer cans and bottles at them. I mean, one officer was seriously injured after being hit by a half-full 2-litre bottle of White Lightning cider. Nevertheless, police were confident that the unfortunate fatality would spell an end to the saga of the Stocksbridge Sasquatch.
Of course, the police just wanted to explain it all away as being the work of a local prankster once this development had occurred. They claimed that that a search of this chap's house had revealed several photographs of him in this gorilla suit. In locations as varied as Canada and Tibet. They wanted us to believe that he's a kind of serial monster impersonator, having posed as both Bigfoot and the Yeti in recent years, fooling people like me, which is obviously absolute nonsense. I mean, just look at the gorilla suit he was supposedly wearing. It's clearly just a cheap, fancy dress suit in two parts. It's just a pair of hairy trousers and a hairy jacket and a cheap mask. I mean, that's not going to fool anyone, for goodness sake. Let alone skilled investigators like myself.
However, revelations made by the dead man's wife have given Townshend's investigation a new impetus.
She told me that after a few drinks, he'd often claim that at the age of 3, he'd been involved in a car crash on a remote part of the North Yorkshire Moors, which had killed his parents. And incredibly, he'd been rescued by a group of cave-dwelling ape men. And he lived with them, so he told her, until the age of 5, when he was found wandering naked on the moors by a group of hikers, and apparently he was incapable of human speech and behaved like an animal, and later when he was in care was rehabilitated, but ever since then he'd had this ape obsession. So you know, this is very exciting because it means basically this man was in fact an ape man, and you know, even now, I mean, you know, this is proof positive that there are Bigfoot type creatures living free in this country, and right now, I'm preparing a new expedition to the North Yorkshire Moors to search for these troglodytes.
His rival Doc Swack remained convinced, however, that there never had been a flesh-and-blood ape-man as such.
It's obvious to me this character was actually possessed by an elemental, which allowed him to transform into an ape-man.
Consequently, Swack stripped naked and donned a pair of antlers in preparation for a pagan ritual intended to summon the elemental. However, unfortunately, whilst performing his pagan rites, which involved him standing atop the children's playground site, stark naked, whilst 4 naked women danced around him, he was arrested by the police for indecent exposure. Curiously, the elemental did not answer his summons. That was Space Belongs to Me, Do You Hear? H.P. Lovecraft inspired piece by The Unnameable. Amongst the highest profile and most perplexing of what we might term high strangeness phenomena is of course that of UFOs and alien abduction. Do we really believe that extraterrestrials are visiting this planet?
I'm convinced, after 13 years of study and investigation, that the Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial vehicles whose origin, in other words, is off the Earth. So-called flying saucers, in other words, are real. There are many cases in which we are dealing with reports of things fewer than 500 feet away from the observer. In some of these cases, the object has been observed on the ground and observed landing and taking off as well, and in some cases accompanied by humanoid-looking creatures. That is, people, two arms, two legs, a head, and a body. Maybe people is the wrong word, but creatures nevertheless.
And now back to UFO, Fact or Fiction. And now Herbert Schirmer picks up where he left off a moment ago when he was telling us about being briefed by the commander of a flying saucer outside Ashland, Nebraska in December 1967.
This object landed and some legs came out and it sat down. I was just sitting there really motionless. I couldn't move. I may have even had my mouth open. I don't remember, you know, being probably scared. This hatch came open. And this light came out of the hatch. And this form came down. And looked the form of a human being. And this form started walking toward the patrol car with an object in both its hands. Appeared to be hands. And he was walking straight toward the patrol car. As he was doing this, another form came out and started walking toward the patrol car also. As this being got in front of the, walked up to the front of the patrol car with this object in his hand, which looked sort of a squarish oval type. It looked like it had a lens in front of it. And the only thing I could think was, oh my God, what's going to happen now?
There was a small being at the door who gestured for me to come in. And then I went in. He directed me to a small table, which similar to an ironing board that comes out of the wall, that long, narrow, unsupported underneath. And I was instructed to get up on that. I disagreed, and I was trying to fight them off. And they just put their hand on me, and I was on the table, and it was lifted up, and I was down flat with no further argument. I couldn't move.
And this green light came out all over the car, and then saw light went back in again. And I felt a sensation then, and then I felt nothing, like I was just there. And
it was only after regressive hypnosis on the part of a very competent psychiatrist 3 years later that they found out what had happened. They each relived the same experience, this bizarre experience of being taken on board by these humanoids against their will, examined, put back out. They were treated as specimens.
They examined me. There was a scraping taken from my arm. They inserted a small a probe of some kind into my abdomen, right above the navel. It looked like a long needle. And they also inserted a little burr, like a, it looked like a burr, a little metal piece, up into my nose, up into the membranes behind my nose. They said it would make it easier for contact again. I thought I was going to die. The noise of it going in through the membrane in my head.
And he said something I don't understand. And he said some more things that I didn't understand or couldn't make out. And I still don't. And then he pointed his hand toward the plate glass window, referred to the stars out there. And he says to me, "Watchman, one day you yourself will see the universe as I have." And he reached up and he touched me on the shoulder. Like this, you know, like grabbing you on the shoulder, like a man does. To steer you away, and he says, "Come with me, watchman." And then he stopped and he said, "Watchman," and I turned around like this to look at him, and he had an object in his hand, a silver object that looked like a big pencil with a round ball on the end of it.
There was no verbal communication. It was mental. I'd hear what he was...
It felt I was like I was getting more input of something that I couldn't understand. He said, this is how our craft operates.
One of the major things that I bring to this subject is a background in advanced technology. So that to me, coming here from another solar system isn't bothersome. It's feasible with what we know now from programs that I have worked on directly. Fusion propulsion systems, for example.
Cone thing was right in the center of the floor. You could see half of it from on top and half of it from the bottom, but it gave off a red glow that sort of, not flashed, but kind of died down and then came back up again.
The behavior of UFOs in the sky, the sudden changes in the direction, the ability to hover, to move straight up and down, to move silently without an exhaust, to go forward and then back along the same line, clearly is not behavior that's achievable with present aircraft. That doesn't mean that it violates the laws of physics.
We walked over, and we went down all the way out of the craft. As we got outside, this other being started walking back toward the spacecraft and boarded it. As we were walking toward my patrol car, and we stopped right by the patrol car, and I turned to look at him, and he was looking at me. And then again, it felt like I was receiving an input of words of some kind that I couldn't understand. And he turned, he sort of lifted his hand, and then he turned and walked back to the spacecraft, floated up inside. This catwalk thing started spinning. The lights started flashing off and on. This red orangish glow came out from beneath it. It started lifting up in the air, and I guess it got about 100 feet high and just shot straight out of sight. Let me tell you, I was scared.
For many years, I was even afraid to walk by the area where that I had met them.
It is clear, if one studies the data, that the government has misled the public. And it is also clear that there have been a number of classified cases. I worked under security for 14 years. Let me assure people that the government can keep secrets if it so chooses. We hear about the ones they can't keep. We don't hear about the ones that they can. So I am absolutely convinced that someplace in the government there's a big collection of UFO data. Whether this means that we've captured one, duplicated it, or whatever, I haven't the faintest idea.
I definitely think there has been a cover-up. I don't think it's going to do much good in the long run. I do feel personally that they are going to be here for some time, that there is going to be a joint future eventually. I don't think they're just flying by. I think they've come to visit.
They thought they scared me, but they didn't. See, that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to scare me, but they didn't scare me because I thought it was kind of funny, and I laughed about it when I read it in the paper and seen all the pictures and everything. But while I was in Boulder, they blew my car up with dynamite, and that really made me mad. I just got through paying for it.
One of the many myths about UFOs is that there haven't been any good sightings, that all sightings have been by typically a drunken bum at 3 o'clock in the morning, that sort of thing.
5 years ago, I had a very, very bad cold, and I sneezed it out. It came out in my Kleenex.
Herb Shermer's encounter with a flying saucer and its crew disturbed many people, including his wife, who said he was crazy and left.
So I'm convinced, in other words, not because I want to believe that we are being visited, not because I wish we were being visited to help us solve our problems, but because the evidence, the data, the reports, the total collection of information that is available to the interested observer is overwhelming.
I have to say that some of the common characteristics in all of these alien abductions, stories you'll find, do rather indicate to me a deep psychological origin for these, rather than being the result of actual alien intervention. It's the alleged abductees consistent accounts of these probings, often anal probes, interestingly, and things inserted into them and being helpless and so on, seem to be have a real sexual subtext. Frankly, if I was a Freudian, I'd have a field day with their accounts of aliens with probes that look like pencils with balls on the end and whatever. That said, it seems to me, however, that these people certainly believe these things have happened. They're sincere in their belief that these things have happened to them. Whether it's an actual objective occurrence or some merely a subjective experience is a good question. Interestingly, a few months ago I was reading about narcolepsy. Now, we all think of narcolepsy as being people who suffer from a disorder whereby they're prone to fall asleep without warning at sort of inappropriate times, or sleep excessively. However, I found this interesting. Many narcoleptics also suffer from other phenomena in that when they sleep, A, they don't realize they're asleep, because they, B, experience very, very vivid and lifelike dreams that when they awake, they cannot distinguish from reality and in fact supplant the real memory of what actually happened. And they end up believing that this dream is what they actually did in these periods of what would otherwise be missing time when they were asleep. Which rather makes one wonder about the whole alien abduction phenomena. That's perhaps why they are so sincere about it, the alleged abductees. They really do believe it. Perhaps they have experienced some kind of similar psychological experience, that phenomena that narcoleptics experience. Who knows? Well, that's it for now. Before Black Widow return to play us out with Conjuration, I'd just like to say that, as far as I'm aware, all the materials used here are in the public domain. If anyone hears this who has any copyright on any of these things here, do let me know, and obviously I will give you proper accreditation. However, most of this was found on archive.org. Some of the sequences, as I say, came from an LP from 1974 entitled Occult Explosion, which can also be found in its entirety on archive.org, where it's been posted in the belief, again, that it is now in the public domain. So that's it for now. As ever, I was Doc Sleaze. If you are like what you heard here, then you can find more of the same sort of stuff over at thesleaze.co.uk. And until the next time, keep it sleazy, folks.
I heard born on the wind to reach my ears, and from the lips I learn to will, and the lies they swear that I will kill my fear, perform the right, and spurred on by my need to have the one I loved before, I'll even steal my heart to raise the devil himself. In this sacred place I stand, I call the Lady Astor, come join me here.
from the lips I learned so well in other lives. I swear that I will kill my fear, perform the right, and spurred on by my need to have the one I loved before. I'll even steal my